Like this show and want to make your own? Let me tell you about Anchor. It's free, and they have creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. And now you can even add any song from Spotify directly to your episodes. The possibilities are endless for what you can create, whether it's music analysis, your own radio show, or something the world's never heard before. Anchor will distribute your podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and many more. And you can also make money from your podcast with no minimum listenership. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. So download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started.
Welcome to the Vocal Fries podcast, the podcast about linguistic discrimination.
I'm Carrie Gillen.
And I'm Megan Figueroa. And we have an exciting episode today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really good.
I know. I teased about it on Twitter and I'm so glad that it's finally coming out. I think it's really good and it's really relevant.
It's really relevant.
Yeah.
It's always relevant, but probably even more so right now.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. Before we get into the interview, there's so much shit happening in the world.
It is true. There's too much going on, really.
Yeah. And maybe it feels like some of these things aren't as important, but I like to think that the little space we've carved for ourselves is making a difference somehow. So it is important that we talk about these things. I was thinking about, you know, since the United States is on fire right now, and it's Supreme Court season. I don't know who it was that said it, but someone, I think it was a New York Times article, described Sonia Sotomayor's dissent against the Muslim ban was lashing out.
Yep, I think it was the New York Times. They've been bad about this kind of stuff recently.
Yeah, and the problem with saying lashing out, this would be problematic if it were just a woman, like straight, like a white woman, right? Because it's tone policing. But for it to be a Latina woman, there's the added element of the stereotype that Latinas are emotional or fiery.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, of course, a lot of times people say that women are hysterical or emotional anyway. But there's this like added layer of Latinas somehow being even more and fiery and ill-tempered or something like that. So, The choice of words was not great.
Yeah. I mean, I think they also said passionate, which is also bad, but right. Somehow not as bad as lashing out.
Right. It's pejorative, right?
I mean, lashing out is pejorative, and passionate can be, but doesn't necessarily have to be.
Right.
Like, if you can be passionate about something in a way that is positive.
Right.
Or you can be passionate about something in a way that's like, oh, calm down, which is, I think, how that came across, and for good reason.
Yeah.
But lashing out really makes it obvious that it's pejorative.
Yeah. And I feel like even with passionate, there's this double standard where if we would have called Justice Kennedy passionate, somehow maybe more people would have cared and would have been like, well, if a man can get passionate about it, then this must be really important. Or there must be a good reason for it.
Right. It's like when Boehner would cry.
Oh.
And that was like seen as a good thing.
Yes.
But if a woman had cried under the same circumstances,
yes,
that would have been horrifying.
Yes. Exactly.
No, I totally agree. I think passionate is bad enough, but in contrast, lashing out is just way worse.
Yeah. I mean, there's no good reason to describe it that way, especially since the part that they were pointing to was her reading the president's own words back at him, I believe. So it wasn't even her own words.
And you know, you should be allowed to lash out at words that are so full of animus.
Yeah, and so, like, fucking racist and Islamophobic. Yep. So, yeah, maybe we should be able to lash out, quote unquote.
Yeah, there's been a lot of tone policing recently, a lot of calls for civility.
Yes.
In the face of horrific violence and trauma.
Right.
Just yesterday, yesterday from when we're recording, so a few days ago for people listening, but
a newspaper office in Maryland was just shot up, and one of the survivors said fuck on TV about it, basically fuck your thoughts and prayers, I want more. And Marco Rubio, among others, are like, oh, why is it okay to say fuck on TV now? Like that's the issue.
Oh, I knew that he tweeted that. Like, he was so upset that the word fuck was being used, and I had no idea it was about that specifically.
Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
Oh my God. Yeah, as if that's the real tragedy here.
Yeah. I mean, this has always been a problem in probably many societies since time immemorial, but right now it just feels like maybe it's because everything's on fire. Like, everything is a dumpster fire. Everything is the worst. And so if you don't want to deal with that, if you want to pretend it's not the case, the only thing that you can do is tone police.
Yeah, it's true. And tone policing is ultimately gaslighting.
It's like saying what you're feeling is not real, or it's not real enough.
Exactly. Exactly. And when it comes from people in positions of power.
And it always does, right? I can't imagine that you can really pull this shit if you're not in some kind of power position.
Right. I mean, they're the trolls on the internet, but usually they're men or white.
Right. And they might have less power than, say, you or me, but there's still people that have less power than us that they're wielding their power over.
Right.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Anyway, today's been, this week has been rough.
Yeah. And I say to it, fuck civility.
Yeah, me too. I've never been one of those, like, civility is the most important thing.
Yeah.
I've been more of a time and place, but recently it's like, well, now there's no time and place for civility. Like, this is an emergency.
Or the time and place is to be uncivil.
Yeah. I guess that's better. That's a better way of putting it.
Yeah.
Yeah, civility's not going to get us anywhere.
Yeah, it's the whole thing where differing opinions can be respected as long as you're not trying to, like, undermine someone's existence. And that's just happening all over the place right now.
Yeah, we're not fighting over, like someone said on Twitter, basically, we can fight over, like, levels of taxation. Like, those are things that we can fight over and still respect each other about. But we can't fight over, women's right to exist, or people of color's right to exist, or like fill in the blank right to exist. We can't fight over that. Like, this is anyway.
Yeah. Well, sorry all of our listeners that are in America right now, the US
or anywhere really, because unfortunately whatever happens here is going to trickle out to other countries in some way or other. I mean, look at all the trade wars.
I know Canada's, putting a lot of tariffs on U.S. goods and such and blah.
Right. And that's going to directly affect Canadians, because many of our products come from the United States. And so the prices are going to go up.
Is this the new trickle-down economics?
Yeah, kind of. Trickle out, anyway.
Yeah. Well, anyway, the world is terrible, but we have an excellent guest and an excellent episode for you doing the interview. I left feeling great after, so.
Yeah, that was a really good episode. I mean, really good interview, for sure.
Oh, and one thing before we get into it, Patreon. We released our June bonus Patreon episode that's usually just for our Patreon $5 a month subscribers, so that you all could see what it's like. So go check that out, and hopefully you'll be like, this is the shit that I need to get into.
Yeah, hopefully you're like, oh, yes, I enjoy just listening to them ramble on about random topics.
Exactly.
Although I think it was a good one, because it was really fun.
Yeah.
So, if you want to join us, you can. The address is patreon.com/vocalfriespod.
Yes.
Yeah. So, and then I hope you enjoy this episode.
All right. So today we are lucky to be joined by Dr. Nelson Flores. He is an associate professor, yay, just got tenure, in educational linguistics at University of Pennsylvania Graduate School of Education. Dr. Flores has a PhD in urban education from the CUNY Graduate School at the City University of New York. His research involves the study of the historical and contemporary instantiations of raciolinguistic ideologies, where language and race are co-constructed in ways that marginalize racialized communities. Nelson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, I mean, I've wanted to have you on anyway, but it just so happens that you are involved in a little bit of a controversy on Twitter. There's a thing happening right now with a so-called 30 million word gap. I thought that it would be great to talk to you about it. So tell us, what is a 30 million word gap?
So the 30 million word gap is an idea that emerged from a study that was published in 1995 that essentially makes the argument that low-income children hear 30 million fewer words than middle-class or upper-class children within the first few years of life, the argument being that that so-called word gap is what is the primary culprit for their academic challenges that they confront in school.
Right. It was born out of this, the meaningful differences in the everyday experiences of young children, right? By Hart and Reasley.
Correct.
So I had to read that book and I was looking over it when I was about to talk to you and I just had to, I mean, this kind of gives you a feel, everyone. So here's one sentence that I highlighted. Quality interactions seem to come so naturally to the parents in well-functioning families as to suggest that a certain amount of quality interaction may be essential to basic language competence. So it's filled with these things. And I don't know, I mean, for you, Nelson, I'm imagining too, there's like a visceral reaction to hearing something like that.
There is. I mean, let's even begin by unpacking what the term quality even means.
Right. It's
a very arbitrary term that is concerning that researchers are using in some type of kind of way that seems like it's objective. Quality is in the eye of the beholder, right? What's quality to one person may not be quality to the other. And what Hart and Reasley and many people who propose the word gap do is that they take practices that have typically been associated with middle class, upper middle class, affluent white populations, and surprise, surprise, they decide that those are quality, which of course is not an objective statement, and one could argue is actually a racist statement to claim that a particular cultural background is higher quality than the other. And to be clear, I'm not suggesting that white middle class and upper class people don't have a rich cultural practices that they engage in. The issue is that all communities have rich cultural and linguistic practices that they engage in. And that's something that the word gap discourse completely ignores. It completely ignores decades of anthropological research that documents the rich cultural and linguistic practices of all communities and supposes that the practices of one is somehow objectively more quality than others.
How then does this get reinforced? Because I know it's in the mainstream consciousness right now, and we'll talk about that in a second, but how has it been reinforced for so many years, for decades?
Well, because it is part of a much longer history where the language practices of racialized communities, of low-income communities, have always been framed through a deficit lens. Now, if we even go back to the early years of European colonialism, we can see racial-linguistic ideologies being used to dehumanize indigenous communities, where people would describe the language practices of indigenous peoples as almost animalistic, as a form of dehumanization. Now, nowadays, people wouldn't say things like, people are speaking like animals, or at least most people wouldn't say that. But the underlying logic of there's something somehow deficient about the language practices of racialized communities has remained consistent since the early days of European colonialism. And so it's not surprising that the 30 million world gap is so seductive because it reinforces all of these ideologies that people have been socialized into accepting for multiple generations.
Right. And you give an example of this in one of your blog posts, or at least an analogy as to the war on poverty or the war on drugs, that these are kind of the things that we grew up with believing that are built on a foundation of racism, but that are trying to be solving some bigger problem, but really we're not addressing the true problem.
Right. I mean, you can trace these discourses. They're consistent throughout history of putting the onus on racialized communities to undo their own oppression by modifying their behaviors rather than undoing the structures that actually are the primary challenges that they confront.
Why is it in the so it's this new article that was published, I believe April 2018 article, very recently, by Speary et al. And so they are refuting Hart and Risley's claim, and people aren't happy. So they refute it by saying that there's incredible variation in the vocabulary environments in different socioeconomic status homes. What Hart and Risley failed to do was to look at sort of a larger picture of the vocabulary that children are getting. Is that right?
Right. So they essentially made the claim that they replicated the Hart and Risley study and found that the differences were really just as big within a social class as between them. Because we have to remember the Hart and Risley sample was a fairly small sample, right? They
yeah.
based their arguments on a sample of six families
right.
that were called, I think, welfare families in the actual book, and have made these broad claims based on six families,
right.
which is questionable in and of itself, right?
Yeah, that's I can't even believe they got away with that. But
And again, I think it's because it's something that people already believe. So people say, oh, yeah, of course, it's true, because it must be true, because we've been taught that it's been true. And so what this new study did was do something similar and find that there actually weren't these huge differences across social class groups. And immediately, they were critiques about the methodology. And I think some of the critiques about the methodology are fair, because no methodology is perfect, right? We always
exactly.
are making decisions about the research we do, and there's always issues with the decisions that we make. But what I found interesting was the fact that people who were critiquing this new study for its methodological, for its supposed methodological flaws, were uncritically citing the Hart and Risley study, which has been critiqued over and over again. So it feels a bit disingenuous to point to the methodological flaws of the new study, which some of them, again, may be fair, without acknowledging that the study that they're citing as the foundation of their work also has extremely questionable methods that they use and are making conclusions that really aren't necessarily reflected even in the data that they have.
Right.
One of the big things that Speary et al. Points out, and you've talked about, is that you're ignoring a lot of the cultural interactions that happen that you can't just look at by asking the parents or the immediate caretakers, what words your child know.
Right. Right. Like, language is not just a series of decontextualized vocabulary words. And more isn't always necessarily better. There are
right.
lots of social practices that we engage in where being concise and using fewer words is actually seen as better than using more words.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So even the idea that more is inherently better isn't
right.
universal and isn't necessarily true. But of course, we actually use language to engage in social practices with other people. So we're not just listing vocabulary words when we're talking to other people. We're engaging in dynamics that we've been socialized into, that we've gradually become familiar with as we become more socialized into those practices. And so to decontextualize language in that way, I think really shows a fundamental misunderstanding of what the function of language is, which is to communicate, which is to engage in practices, not to memorize vocabulary lists. Now, schools may like people to memorize vocabulary lists, but that's a different argument, right? If what you're saying is that these are the types of decontextualized language practices that they're expected to be successful with in school, then that's a different conversation, because then I would argue, well, why are we using these decontextualized language practices in school when we know that in the real world, that's not how people actually use language? Maybe the problem isn't that these particular students haven't mastered a particular list of decontextualized vocabulary words, but rather the fact that schools have decontextualized language from the practices in which they're engaged in. And I think that may be part of, that would be a more interesting conversation for me than to look at these decontextualized vocabulary words.
Right. I have a question about the original studies. So, or actually both studies together. They do have different methodology, even though one is sort of based on the other. Can you explain what the differences are? Because I think that's really what people were fighting about, right?
So I think that the biggest concern that people have raised about the newer study was that it doesn't include a class of professionals. So it includes like lower class and middle class, but doesn't include the professional class that was in the original Hart and Risley study. And so in that sense, it's not an actual complete replication. Although I don't think that necessarily discounts the findings, though, that when we're looking across social classes, there aren't these stark differences that the original study had indicated.
Right.
And so I don't think that we can determine one way or the other whether there are these huge differences. We have one study that suggests that there are. We have another study that suggests that there aren't. My issue is that I don't even think that that's the right question to be asking. That I don't think the right question is to ask how many words are children being hearing at home. Because as I was just saying, that's not actually what language is, right? Language isn't right. The number of words we hear. It's the practices that we're being socialized into. And in order to understand those practices, we really need more rigorous ethnographic work, right? Like, it's not something yes. that can be done just by counting words. We actually need to observe and document the practices where those words are embedded in. And anthropology has shown us for decades that regardless of how many words people may or may not be hearing, that they're being socialized into complex practices.
Yes, I think that was actually what I was trying to get at is this, because I think one of the differences is the first study was all about child-directed speech only, if I'm remembering correctly, and the second study includes all speech spoken around children.
Right.
Yes.
And that's important.
It is. And I'm thinking, because like reading Hart and Risley, it doesn't even, the way that they talk about what language is, it doesn't even look like what my childhood was like. And I'm like, if you're just focusing on parents, you're not looking at the fact that my Theo came over like 2 days a week. And that I would spend so much time at my grandma's house, and I always had cousins running around. What about all those interactions that are happening? And that's what you're saying. We can't not look at context and how language works in those contexts.
Right. And I think something else that is methodologically questionable in Hart and Risley, and again, this isn't a critique per se, but more just like a challenge of methodology, is that when you bring a recorder into homes, that can impact the dynamics too.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
Where, like, if you're one that they're calling a welfare family and you have people in your home recording, that might have different connotations to you than if you're a professional who maybe wants to show off to the researcher, right?
Exactly.
And so we don't know exactly how to kind of make sense of that, but I do think it's a methodological issue that really needs to be considered.
Yeah, you could have people who actually look like the people that you're studying being the recorders, at least that might help a little.
Right. I still think about how, like, we always dodged, like, we always hid when someone knocked on the door. I'm like,
right,
I don't
exactly.
think we're going to, like, let anyone into our house to do that.
Yeah, even coming from a middle-class family, I can't imagine participating in that as a child. It would have terrified me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, me as a child, too. Thinking about, like, how we are individual characteristics of children, I would have been like, no, stranger, I'm not going to talk. Like, I probably would talk less. So
Right. But I could imagine a professional parent knowing what the right thing to do is.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. knowing that the recorder is on, doing the things that they know are the right things to do, because maybe they write it somewhere, right? And maybe that's not always what they do. Maybe they actually aren't talking to their kids all the time. Maybe sometimes the kids are watching TV. But they know when the recorder is on that they shouldn't be watching TV, right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, and they'll not use as many directives. That seems so. I hated that when I was reading it. The whole directives thing just felt so, I don't know. I couldn't really like point out how or why it offended me so much. Maybe because my parents used a lot of directives.
Can you explain directives?
Oh, yeah. So like saying a directive would be like, clean your room, instead of saying, well, it looks like your room's a little messy. What do you think you should do about that? Like, that's what they want people to say.
They want people to be more passive aggressive?
Yes, they think that that's quality.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. Right. And I'm like...
No, as a Canadian, I'm just going to say no. Less is better on that front.
But of course, that reminds me of the work of Lisa Delpit, right? Who kind of looked at the cultural differences in parental communication and found in her work with African-American parents that they were more directive than in white middle-class families. And then what happens when those children get to school is that the teachers who have been socialized, because most of the teachers are white women by demographics, they've been socialized into this more passive way of making requests, where they'll say, don't you think you should be doing this? The child may not actually understand that actually was a directive, right? Because it was a directive, yeah. Right? The teacher was making a request, and the child didn't necessarily understand that as a request, and maybe actually thought that they had a choice when you say, don't you think you should? And which gets, again, to the importance of understanding cultural difference and not assuming that one is more quality than the other. I mean, Lisa Delpit makes it very clear in her work that it's not that Black parents care less about their children. They love their children. They have a particular history where maybe there are needs to be more directive, because if not, their child isn't going to be socialized to deal with an anti-Black world
exactly.
That expects people to expects Black people in particular to adhere to directives, right?
Exactly. I mean, I guess that's what it really was when I was reading and kept hearing about directives and them basically shitting on directives. I'm like, oh, it feels racism is dripping off of this. And they may have not, again, I think Carrie said it once about sexism, called it benevolent sexism.
I did not make up that term.
Well, I know. The first time I heard it was you saying it on something. But is this like benevolent classism and racism, you think?
I mean,
I don't know. I don't know if it's benevolent.
I don't know. I mean, I actually am one who's not particularly interested in what one's intentions are. And so it's like, I'm sure they had good intentions. I mean, I don't think people do research or at least social science research without wanting to make a difference and help. But it doesn't really matter in the grand scheme of things.
You're right.
If you can, you're still producing racism. And I think that even terms like covert racism, oftentimes I find problematic, because who are they covert to? Like oftentimes the victim
other
of
white
it
people.
Is quite right. Conscious of it, and it's not
yeah,
covert.
Yeah.
It's only covert to the one who isn't aware that they're being racist, right? And so I think that for me, it's like less important what their intentions are and more about, I think that the framework that they're using is fundamentally flawed and has led to interventions that are quite damaging. And I know that sounds maybe extreme in some ways, but I do think that interventions that are coming from a racist deficit perspective are damaging to children.
Right. So let's talk about impact, because one of the impacts, this is a big impact, at University of Chicago, there is a 30 million word center for early learning and public health, and they get tons of money. You go to their website and there's a donate button, but you know they're getting government money and grants and stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's, I mean, I don't mean to shit on the director. Anyone goes to the website and looks at the videos, it feels gross. You see like white people telling Black parents like what to do with their children, and it feels terrible. That's a huge thing that's getting tons of money because of the so-called 30 million word gap from Hart and Reasley. Like that's a direct impact of that study.
Right.
It's named after it.
And what's happening to these kids? Like, what are they provided with in this program?
Intervention, quote unquote intervention, based on let's not have the directives. Let's open it up so there's more questions so children can answer back, like this kind of thing.
I see.
Yeah. So they are trying to change the way that caregivers interact with their children. And that's just inherently icky to me.
Right. Well, I think that all of the money going into it might give you some indication for why people were so defensive about a response that called it into question. Because there is a lot of money that's going into it. I mean, remedial compensatory education, which has been funded by government and non-government officials since at least the 60s, that are designed to fix the so-called cultural and linguistic deficits of racialized communities, have always been a very lucrative industry. There's always been tons of money going into it. I mean, I don't even know how much money, probably billions of dollars at this point, honestly. And I always wonder, like, what would the world look like if we actually like invested that money in revitalizing communities and like ending poverty and like ensuring that children had access to quality healthcare,
or even just textbooks?
Yeah,
like simple educational funding.
Right. I think our society finds fixing racialized communities as a seductive narrative.
Yeah,
because it really leaves the rest of the society off the hook, right? So we don't have to reflect on the root causes of racial inequalities, because we can just say, oh, it's their fault because they're not asking their children questions. I don't know how anyone who has any experience working in neighborhoods that have experienced multiple generations of racialized poverty could possibly think that changing the way that you ask questions to your child or increasing the number of words that you give them is really going to be what's the make it or break it for whether that child is going to thrive or not, right? It's like these are children who sometimes struggle with homelessness, right? These are children who have food insecurity. In Philadelphia, lead poisoning has been a huge issue. And that's, I know it's in other places as well, like Flint, right?
Right.
All of these structural issues that are much more salient in the lives of these children and these families, right? But in education circles, we tend to think that none of that has anything to do with like what we should be talking about, right? We should just be talking about fixing the kids. And I think that one is misguided because of all of these other challenges that I think are much more salient. But two, it then socializes teachers to come from the perspective that the kids are broken and need to be fixed, right? And that is not a productive perspective to begin with, especially when we look at the demographics of teachers versus students, when there's already this divide between them, right? The last thing that we want to do is increase that by telling teachers that their job is to be like these people in that website that you were talking about, these benevolent white people who are trying to fix racialized communities, right? That's not a productive stance. It's never worked in the past, and it's not going to work now.
It is a seductive line of thinking for a lot of people because it's kids. So like a lot of people are like, this is seductive because, oh, if I support it, I'm helping the children. You motherfuckers. help kids in other ways. Sorry, we do have an explicit rating.
This also reminds me of work on Inuit children in Quebec. So when they go to school, obviously the schools are mostly, or at least at back when this research was done, mostly white people. And so they grow up in the Inuit communities where there's not a lot of child-directed speech. And so then they get into the classroom and suddenly this adult is talking to them and they're not used to it and they don't know how to respond at all. Yeah, so the different communities do different things and we just assume white is the norm, white North American is the norm and everyone should behave like us, and it's really fucked up.
Right. And the thing is that if Hart and Risley said that, and the people who support the 30 million workup said that, at least I would respect that they were coming from a position of authenticity, right?
It's true.
But the fact that they try to frame it as objective, I think, is what makes it even more insidious, right? It's like, no, there's no objective basis for determining that being non-directive is more quality, right? That's not an objective statement. It's coming from a particular ideological position. So if you can own that position, if you can say, yes, I think that all racialized communities should behave just like white people, I would disagree with you, but at least I would say, well, you're being honest with what your perspective is and you're not hiding it behind this veil of objectivity.
I just translated it for people.
It's a more quality interpretation than theirs.
But you're right. I have the exact same objection. Just say what you're actually saying. People like to be really sneaky. They might not even know they're being sneaky. I have a feeling that they don't, because they really believe in their own objectivity. But none of us are objective. No. None of us. How can you be?
Right. Yeah. When people say that science is objective, I'm like, whose science? What science are you talking about? It's just not, you know, like we're all humans coming to it with our biases. And then I go right into saying that me as a psycholinguist, just completely psycholinguistic perspective of working in infant labs and looking at child language, this just doesn't make sense anyway. Like, even if we're not looking at culture and looking at the bigger picture, which I always think we should look at culture and the people, even if we're just looking at how infants learn language, this just doesn't make sense to tell parents don't use directives. Like, you know, it doesn't make sense.
No. And as a white middle class person, my parents use directive speech with me for sure. I just don't even understand this argument. It's a thing that exists.
and Nelson, right? That's like the big thing with them is directives versus asking questions, right?
That's one of the big things. Yeah, no, that is one of the big things.
Yeah.
I mean, right, I think what they did was that they kind of imagined this idealized kind of white middle class family and imagined what that family must be like, which was probably their family.
Right. Exactly.
And they kind of came up with these arbitrary characteristics that they decided were quality. And I think that is something that isn't just Hart and Riesley, though. I think that on a lot of kind of linguistic analysis, especially like in second language acquisition, there are kind of these discussions of complex language or richer language that isn't oftentimes theorized. Well, like, well, complex from whose perspective, right? Richer from whose perspective? Like, these aren't objective designations. They may seem so because we've naturalized and normalized all of these dominant ideologies about what language is or should be. But we can't describe language outside of an ideological perspective on what language is, right? And I always try in my work to be very explicit in terms of how I'm thinking about language, and in particular, how I'm thinking about language and race and how they co-construct with one another. And so my ideological position, I tried to put on the table and say, this is my perspective, this is where I'm coming from, this is kind of my stance. And oftentimes then get accused of being ideological, right?
Yeah, that's the trap that white people set for you.
Well, you said it. I mean, I oftentimes refuse to fall into the trap because my response is to point out the ideological assumptions and what they're doing and say, good. I own mine, you own yours, and then we can agree to disagree. But until you own yours, you're not allowed to call me ideological.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. So thinking, here's a transition for you. I don't want it to all be negative. What is a good framework to think about this? You've mentioned, again, we'll post to these two blog posts that are specifically that you have about this issue that are great. Language socialization framework. Is that what you're still working with right now, or where you think we should be working from? And tell us what it is.
Right. I mean, I think language socialization, which emerged, I think, probably like in the 70s, right? In kind of anthropology, and I think in particular anthropology of education has had the most interest in it for obvious reasons, is just looking at, from an ethnographic perspective, the ways that people come to know language, right? And the ways that they come to know particular ways of using language. So from a linguistic, and certainly a linguistic anthropological perspective, we're all socialized into the practices of our home, right? And these are all practices that are complex. These are all practices that are nuanced. These are all practices that provide a foundation for us to engage in the world. And I think what language socialization research helps us then to think about is, if we're starting from the perspective that all children are socialized into complex language practices, and there isn't an inherent hierarchy in terms of the complexity, then how do we incorporate the language practices of all children into the classroom? How do we stop framing certain language practices as deficient and in need of remediation? And I think that that's a more productive beginning of a conversation. And I think there are lots of different ways you can answer that, right? And I think that mm-hmm. teachers as professionals have to decide and figure out how that's going to look for them in their particular classrooms, because all classrooms are different, all communities right. are different, so it's going to look different in different contexts. But it's a much more productive point of entry into the conversation. And so, like, work that I've done with teachers in Philadelphia, which fit the community here, was thinking about the ways that in elementary school bilingual classrooms, we could strategically use translingual texts. So texts that are primarily written in English, but have some Spanish in them, mm-hmm. as a point of entry for helping students engage first in close readings of the text, which is a Common Core aligned literacy strategy. But two, and that's important for teachers to be able to justify, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And yeah. two, as a point of entry for helping students realize that they, as bilingual authors, actually can strategically choose to bring both languages together for particular effects and with particular purposes, right? So rather than saying, oh, that kind of other language that you use at home is not relevant here, it's saying, well, actually, it can be relevant. If you're writing a story, for example, about something that you did with your grandmother, and your grandmother speaks Spanish, you as the author can decide to use Spanish as dialogue in that text, right? So you can bring some of those home language practices into your writing, and that you should do that. And I think right. it's a very different stance to the home language practices of students than to say, oh, they hear 30 million words less, so let's fix them.
Right.
And how empowering is it to hear or see Spanish in the classroom for these kids? You know, it's so big. It's so important. And I think that's lost on some people, because some people might say we're all talking about representation right now and how it's important, but it really is. And representing that home language in the classroom is really important.
Right. And I think it's not only representing the home language, but also representing the fact that these are bilingual children growing up in a bilingual yeah. community, which yeah. means that they are bilingual authors, right? And bilingual yeah. authors have more tools, perhaps, yeah. than monolingual authors, or perhaps not, because monolingual authors maybe have different dialects, right? But that we all as authors should be strategically deploying all of our communicative repertoires in order to create our voice as authors, which is very different than saying, make everyone talk like a white person, right?
Right.
and I think yeah. it's okay, let's socialize students into new ways of using language, which is part of the function of school, right? We yeah. all learn, mm-hmm. I mean, we all did doctorates, right? So we were all socialized into new ways of mm-hmm. using language and new ways of thinking as doctoral students, right? That's just part of what we're doing all the time in our daily lives. And yeah. we're always going to be being socialized into new ways of using language. So I certainly don't want to be misunderstood as saying we shouldn't socialize students into new language practices, because sometimes people accuse me of saying we should just let them do whatever they want and not teach them anything. And I think that that's silly. I don't know who would ever argue that.
Mm-hmm. You know what that reminds me of is the prescriptive versus descriptive debate. If you're a descriptivist, you're accused of saying, oh, anything goes. And that's not right. exactly yeah, yeah. what we're
right,
saying.
Which is, of course, not the point. It's, no. it's looking yeah, yeah. at how people actually use language, right? Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
So schools certainly have an important function of socializing students into new language practices that are associated with tasks that are associated with school. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that could be improved in school is that maybe some of those tasks could be less kind of decontextualized vocabulary list and more kind of actual authentic interactions. I think that's one of the things that schools could do better, certainly. But certainly schools should be socializing students into new language practices. The question is how they should be doing that, right? And from my perspective, the way they should be doing that is building on the knowledge that the children already have. Now, anyone who's taken an education course ever knows that the first basic thing that you learn in Pedagogy 101 is if you want students to learn new content, you have to connect it to their prior knowledge, right? That's the first thing you learn. So why do we think language is any different? If you want students to learn new language practices, you have to connect it to language practices they're already familiar with, right? And once you do that, they're much more able to then retain it, remember it, feel like it's part of who they are, and not feel like it's this thing that's completely removed from who they are as people and who they understand themselves to be.
That's a really good point.
You're gonna make me cry. I'm like, why didn't I have that when I grew up?
Well, I know, and why we still don't have it? Well, we still don't have it because social science researchers are still talking about a word gap. So part of the problem is researchers.
Yeah. No, absolutely. That was one of the questions that kept coming up in my mind was, okay, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's obvious to me that this is what we need to do. But how do we get from here, where we are now, to where we should be, given this juggernaut of the social science research, the education research, which sometimes aligns with that, the fact that the education system is this huge bureaucracy.
Policymakers,
the politicians involved. How? how do we make even a small change?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
What can our listeners do? What can we do?
Right. What can any of us do? If a policymaker is listening, what could they do?
Yeah. Yes. We have so many politicians that listen to this show.
I said
they should. They definitely should.
I know.
So I mean, I think when I want to give a cop-out answer, which I'll give first, and then I'll give like the better answer. One, I do think that what you're alluding to is true, that we need a fundamental transformation of the institutions that children are in, right? And I think that that change isn't going to happen overnight. And that change happens over generations. And some of that has happened, right? Like looking as someone who has studied the history of bilingual education in the United States, the fact that there are some children in Philadelphia and in other cities who are able to be in classrooms where Spanish is not only acknowledged, but used as part of instruction, and that allows new immigrant children to come in and seamlessly become incorporated into the classroom. That was a fundamental transformation of that institution that happened over generations, right? So when people say, oh, we can never dismantle structural racism, I say, yeah, people have. Like, things are not the exact same as they were before, and that change has come because of political struggle, right? So I think that's kind of the bigger answer, is that we have to keep engaging in political struggle, knowing that many of the changes that we're advocating for may not benefit us or our children, but maybe will benefit our grandchildren or our great-grandchildren or our descendants if we're not having children.
Right, in other ways,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So like now what teachers can do on their kind of day-to-day, because I do think that teaching still matters within that kind of whole argument I just made, is really thinking about how they can strategically build on the home language practices of children. And you don't have to know those languages in order to be able to do that, right? One thing that is very easy for an elementary school teacher to take a few minutes to do is to acknowledge that there are children in the class who speak languages other than English and to ask them how to say a few words in that language, right? You don't have to know the language, but you're acknowledging that there are children in your class who do know those languages, right? That translingual unit plan that I mentioned is another example. Like really thinking about how to create units that acknowledge and build on the rich linguistic knowledge that all children come in with, and really thinking about how you build on that background knowledge. And I think that really requires kind of a space for teacher inquiry to really kind of reflect on their practices and to think about those practices. And that happens in some schools, certainly. So I think that that's what can happen at the teacher level. And at the policy level, I think in terms of bilingual education, for example, something that there is oftentimes a dearth of is Spanish or any other language. I mean, Spanish is a challenge. You can imagine it's even harder for other languages. Just an infrastructure for supporting the development of those languages, right? And that can include unit exemplars. I mean, and it can include standards. Like, I know that the way that standards are implemented are sometimes problematic, but there's nothing inherently wrong with giving teachers some standards in terms of what students are expected to do at their grade level, right? Like, that's a good thing to give teachers. But teachers who are instructing in languages other than English oftentimes don't have even that to start with. And so they're kind of building things from scratch and constantly reinventing the wheel. So I think that is something that could happen from a policy perspective. Now, in terms of language variation in English, we've tried that from a policy perspective before, and it was kind of this big political turmoil in Oakland.
Yes.
I think that something like that wouldn't hopefully lead to this political turmoil would also be important. Like, how do we work with teachers to acknowledge and value language variation in English and in languages other than English for bilingual programs? But then how do we institutionalize that at the policy level? Like, how do we provide, perhaps in our standards, we could build a standard that is about recognizing language variation, which would then mean that teachers have to focus on language variation as part of what they're doing with their children, because it's part of the benchmarks that the students are expected to make. So I think those tweaks can help us in the present while we keep a long-term vision of, well, that's not enough, right? And we want a lot more than that, but we're going to keep pushing for that for the future. And part of, I think, the role of academics and scholars and researchers in doing that is to call ourselves out for our bullshit, right? And to say, we actually have contributed to these problems, even as we've always tried to position ourselves as the ones with the solutions, right? And so, like, what I do in my academic work is a lot of that, right? Where it's like, wait a minute, like, we complain that teachers are using deficit frameworks. So why don't we look at the deficit frameworks that are being used to inform our research? Because they're not any better, and oftentimes they're even worse because we're pretending that they're objective.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow, that was an amazing answer. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you so much.
Because I struggle with these kind of big picture problems in my head. Like, you know, I'm really concerned with indigenous languages, and there's, you know, huge structural reasons why these languages are struggling. But I don't also want to ever give out the idea that, oh, well, therefore we should give up, or there's no point trying. No, we should try. So thank you for that answer.
Yes. Yeah, no, I mean, after like the first half of talking about like what the fuck is wrong and what's happening, why is this all like on fire? It's really nice to be grounded again in the fact that we can do some things. And I think that we have really great listeners who actually do want to do things or who have learned a lot about their own internalized biases. And I think that this is going to be really, really helpful and educational episode for them. So I really appreciate you coming on. I know that if you're at least on Twitter, you've seen one article going around about this. So, you know, like, people have heard about this right now. And so it's fantastic to have you on. I think that was a really great takeaway. Do you have any other things that you want to hype up or or say before we let you go?
I guess so. Something that I have just, it's in press, so it's going to be published soon, that I think kind of relates to what I was just saying, actually, is really thinking about the theory of change that we have in critical applied linguistics, right? And so oftentimes in our work with teachers, we tend to frame the issue as we need to raise the consciousness of teachers, and we kind of frame it as an individual thing. But the issue that we look at in this article, and I say we because two of my doctoral students wrote it with me, are the ways that broader sociopolitical processes impact what is possible in a classroom and what we call what institutional listening subject positions teachers aren't able to have it. So the school that we look at is a bilingual school. So we look at the ways that bilingualism is completely normalized in the school. But we think of that not solely as great teachers, and they are great teachers, but because of the history of political struggle that has allowed for these spaces to emerge. And so it's a combination of teachers who are on board and the possibility of this space emerging through political struggle. But we also look at issues of policing and also think about that as not purely just about, oh, let's tell the teachers not to police, because oftentimes the teachers are policing because they know that if a child who's a child of color from a low-income community uses particular linguistic tokens outside of the classroom, people are going to racio-linguistically police them, right? And say, you can't say that. Yeah. I can say that as a white person, someone might say, but you can't.
Right.
And so it's not enough to say, oh, we should just tell the teachers to value the students' language practices, when oftentimes the teachers do want to, but they struggle with this institutional listening subject position where they see themselves as listening on behalf of others, right? So, okay, well, we're okay with them saying, yeah, but maybe someone outside of here is going to judge them for saying, yeah. Even though at the University of Pennsylvania, we actually started documenting this as we wrote the article. We say, yeah, all the time at the University of Pennsylvania, right? And if anyone were to correct us, they would come off as completely inappropriate and pompous. So like, it's like, which spaces are these linguistic tokens policed, and what histories are being cited in those spaces, and how it's really not just about individual teachers. It's really this broader socio-historical process that has allowed for this emergence of policing to begin with. And so it connects to the point I was making before, where we conclude there that any efforts at raising the consciousness of teachers has to also be situated within broader political struggles that then can allow teachers to inhabit new listening subject positions, right? And people, when they say it's impossible, I say it happened before, right? We have normalized bilingualism in some public schools in the United States because people have pushed for the possibility of new listening subject positions in these institutions. So we have to keep thinking about, what do we want teachers to be able to do, and how can we transform the institutions to allow them to be able to do that?
And see, that was an issue that, you know, I wasn't really thinking about, but when you mention it, it's like, of course, which reminds me that there's always learning to be done. Even if you've studied this all your life, right, there's still learning to be done.
Yeah, absolutely.
And here's my PSA for listeners, is to follow Nelson on Twitter, which we will link to him, but so that we can hear more about that study, and I'm sure you'll talk about it and all the studies that come out of your work. Yeah, is that what I meant? Studies
yes.
come out of your work. Anyway, yes, all your work that comes out that we can follow, because I learn a lot from you. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, don't be assholes, guys.
Don't be an asshole.
I mean, that Nelson, we always leave our listeners with that. That's the big message. I mean, overall, right? Like, everything we talked about over the last almost hours, don't be an asshole.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Nelson Flores, and it was great talking to you.
Thank you. Great talking to you, too.
Bye.
Bye.
The Vocal Fries podcast is produced by Chris Ayers for Halftone Audio. Theme music by Nick Granum. You can find us on Tumblr, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Vocal Fries Pod. You can email us at vocalfriespod@gmail.com.